So I guess the most fresh thing on our minds is Google Stadia, which had their very first Nintendo Direct today.
Yes, it's a clear ripoff of what Nintendo usually does in lieu of physical events. So for all we know, it wasn't the Google Stadia Connect, wasn't live, and probably just a recording done weeks in advance or something.
Yeah, it's a faux live stream, and it's gone well for Nintendo, I think. I think those things attract a lot of attention. They're live, but they're not live.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was interesting to me. I'm not a gamer, so I was not super into just, like, the entertainment value of it. And I've never really watched many Nintendo Directs either. I think the only one I ever watched was the Smash Bros. Ultimate one, maybe. That's just not my thing. But, I mean, I will say, I guess for that audience, it does a pretty good job of conveying all the information they wanted to convey today, which was a lot of information, actually.
Yeah, we've known about the features of Stadia since March, since E3, but the biggest questions have been games and how is this going to be priced. So what we got today was a Stadia Pro subscription for $9.99 per month with this library of games that you can play from. New titles, bigger titles will be extra. And when you buy those, you get to own them. And then, but for everybody else who just wants a free service, who doesn't want to pay $10 a month or buy a game, or who doesn't want to pay that $10 a month, there's Stadia Base, as Google is calling it, wherein you buy those games outright.
Right.
Was this the model you're expecting?
Yeah, so I think, didn't we talk about this on Alphabet Scoop like several weeks ago, right around GDC? We got a tip about this, and I think the gist of the tip, if I remember correctly, was that they were toying around with a way to do both, which would be you know, subscriptions. We had an entire like 20-minute conversation about this, if I remember correctly, but it was both some kind of level of subscription service and some level of being able to purchase games. And Google was apparently toying with both models and considering both. And that's what we ended up with. We really did end up with both happening. Stadia Pro, as you mentioned, is going to be kind of the Netflix-esque streaming service kind of thing. Yeah. That's $10 a month, and you do, I think our tip actually did specifically mention that the library you would have access to with this subscription service would be older games. And that's what we got. It seems like if you're a Stadia Pro subscriber, you'll get access to some quote-unquote older games, which I don't know what defines old and new. A year old, 4 years old,
maybe current is a better current generation. Maybe current generation and new games.
But whatever the case is, that's what you're getting access to. We don't know how many games that will be. It seems like the current list is at like 20, 25, 30 games. Somewhere in there. I can't remember the exact number, but and it's also not clear which games will be part of this library, so to speak, of games that you'll be able to access through Stadia Pro, and the actual games that you can just directly purchase. And will there be overlap? Will there be some games that are both, that if you have Stadia Base, you can purchase the game and play it via that, and it will also be just available in the library if you're a Stadia Pro subscriber? I think that seems inevitable that will be the case. But the question I think to me is, will there be games that are only available as purchase outright games and not available ever on the streaming side of things, or maybe delayed a year or whatever?
Yeah, it's on the streaming side. Windowing.
But the very first game will be Destiny 2, apparently, which I'm just not a gamer, so I'm just not qualified to talk about any of this because I've never played hardly any of the games that they talked about, and none of them excite me either, quite frankly.
So Destiny 2 is best described as space plus some sort of magical element plus technology. It's a whole mix of genres, and it's the later versions, the Destiny 2 has gotten some backlash, but Bungie, the people who originally made Halo, are behind this, and it has quite an audience. So
yeah, for sure.
I think Google made a correct choice, and they are featuring it, they are featuring Destiny 2, for sure.
Yeah. And
so, but
yeah, what were you gonna say?
I was going to say to talk about the actual Stadia Pro.
Oh yeah.
So it's $10 a month, $9.99 in the US. You get 4K content can be streamed to you at a maximum of 4K 60 frames per second HDR, 5.1 surround sound, all that. And this, and as part of this subscription, when you buy games, you also get some sort of discount. And this is in comparison to Stadia Base, where it's just 1080p and 30 frames per second. And it's, I do wonder if people will be streaming at 4K 60 frames per second in terms of like internet connection and whether they can be whether they are able to do that.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, the average internet speed is 10 a second, 10 down, yeah. And in the United States,
that's 720p.
That's like the bare minimum for Stadia. And I guess 35 you max out. So anything above, I don't know how that works. If you have 100, are you gonna have better frame rates than you do at 35? Yeah, is that gonna make a difference?
Probably it maxes out. Hopefully it maxes out.
So I mean, I don't know, but yeah, I mean,
yeah.
What do you think about Stadia Pro? Like, do you? You mentioned how you're not really a gamer either, and so you're averse to buying physical boxes. Like you may have an Xbox game or two that you might want to play, but you just can't because
I don't. As a techie person, I have no. I've never had a fee. I don't want to keep track of another ecosystem of another box. I already, between mobile and desktop and wearables, there's, for me personally speaking, there's too much to keep up with. So I like this idea of this device agnostic service, so I can just, it stays up to date. It's not really that much visible to me. I don't have to keep a box that might break in the future and all that kind of stuff.
My gut reaction was that this would just not be very attractive because, it is really cheap to just get a box. I mean, for a lot of people, if you don't already own a console, it's pretty cheap to get a box and buy used games at GameStop. GameStop, by the way, 33% drop stock price today. So, unrelated, but they're it's funny the coincidence of Stadia being announced and GameStop falling apart as a company at the same time. So, but anyways, yeah, I mean, that's to me, it just seems I don't see there's many challenges. One of them being, you know, if you're already an Xbox gamer and you already have friends who have Xbox gamer tags and you're already playing online with them, are you going to jump over to Stadia? I just don't see that happening. It just doesn't make sense because you're leaving your community. And as we know, the gaming, like in gaming, the online community is a make or break. It's what makes the experience. There are a lot of people who will buy an Xbox and not a PlayStation 4 just because the friends that they want to play with have Xboxes, or they want to play Xbox exclusive games online, or vice versa. And so that kind of duopoly, I don't see Stadia coming in and being like dismantling that duopoly because, it's going to take a long time before you have friends, like I'm talking teenagers who are in high school or college kids or whatever, you know, like, hey, you want to play this game? Oh yeah, I have it on Stadia. You know, it's like, it's going to take a long time for those network effects to go anywhere. So that's one of the challenges that I see. Someone made a good point though. One very good point that I saw on Twitter today was that kids wanting to play games, it's a much easier sell to mom to say, hey, I want this game, and I can get it right now on my Chrome browser for $30 or $60 or whatever and play it with a controller I may already own. Rather than having to go out and buy a console and do the whole, you know, nine yards. So, I mean, that's an interesting point that I hadn't thought of. There's tons of kids out there who are going to be getting into games in the next 5 years who this might be their first exposure. Stadia might be their very first exposure to AAA titles. And that is a potential market, I think.
I think this is why Google is doing it. I think they see the scale, the new customers, in targeting the average person in targeting this new audience where people don't want to spend money. They don't want there to be a long lead time from thinking that I want the game to start playing. You don't have to set up a box. You don't have to connect stuff to your TV, plug other stuff out. It's yes, these boxes are so cheap, but at the same time, they do require a level of overload that it's harder than clicking a link.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a big difference too. And to see why is Google is doing this in the first place. Yeah. They've identified the market.
Yeah, honestly, sometimes I think of myself too, because I wonder if I might be part of Google's target here, because I am a techie person. I'm on the internet. I'm on YouTube all the time. I'm extremely online. You know, I do play some games. I play games on my phone. I'm a casual gamer. I play some games on my Switch. But, you know, it's like the barrier to entry for a AAA title is too high for me to care enough. My barrier for entry is either buying Steam or getting Steam on my computer, which, by the way, I have a gaming PC that has been sitting collecting dust for the last couple of years because I just don't play games enough. So, you know, buying a game on Steam and downloading a 7 gig file is just, and paying $60 for it, it's just not attractive to me and just doesn't line up with my lifestyle at all. At least not anymore. It used to. And so I wonder if I might be part of the target market, because if I'm watching a YouTube video, a viral YouTube video of someone playing some AAA title, and I can click a single button and pay $20 for that game and have it added to my Stadia library and be able to play it anywhere I want on my phone. And, you know, it's like suddenly I might be a customer to some of these AAA titles that the barriers to entry might have been too high for me, because I don't care enough to go out and buy a console, but I might care enough to click a button and buy it for $20.
Yeah.
So.
There are some other parts of the service to discuss. The controller, the Stadia controller,
sure,
made by Google, $69. That's within the range of the Xbox and PlayStation. We've handled it. We've seen it. I/O and GDC. It looks fine. I think we have to get a hands-on with it to really test this Wi-Fi connectivity approach. So that's going to be interesting. But the more interesting thing that Google did today was this Founders Edition, where you get the controller, you get a Chromecast Ultra, which by itself is a $140 value. And then you get a 3-month subscription to Pro, to Stadia Pro, as well as another subscription that you can give to a buddy pass. And you'll be one of the first people to get your Stadia username, gamer tag, whatever.
Yeah.
So that this is $129. This hardware, I don't know. As not a gamer, I for some reason found this hardware aspect to be the most interesting.
Yeah, I was tempted by the $129. It just seems like a really good deal to me.
It feels like
Chromecast or Google Home Mini level value, which is something we've talked about on the show a lot. It's like $129 for, I mean, I've played with a controller and used it, you know, for minutes, not hours, but minutes, and long enough to know that it's a really high quality controller. So I don't think $69 is outrageous for the controller at all, because I really do think, based on my short experience with it, you're getting a controller that's up to par with the Xbox One, you know, package controller that comes in the box, or the DualShock 4. So I think that value is there, even if it's just the Chromecast and the controller. And so, you know, getting all the perks and 3 months of Stadia Pro, 3 months of a subscription service, and, you know, all the other stuff is I feel like they made a pretty good value proposition, and I was really tempted to get it. The only reason I haven't is because I might be getting the review unit. and that's another interesting point, is that I'm not a gamer, like, at all. Like, I would have thought that I'm not the person that would be tempted by this at all.
Yeah.
Now you but are. I am. And so it's kind of a proof that there's a little bit of validity to this,
which Google has been arguing. It's for everyone. So I think before we wrap up Stadia, I guess there's one big question. Will this be successful for Google? Where Google Podcast, this is a new business that Google's trying to achieve. Will this be successful? And one thing that shocked me this morning is the idea that $10, you get a library of games, you pay $120 a year, I am really curious how much this costs, how much maintaining each stream is to a user from Google's data centers, all the R&D work Google had to do in putting GPUs in the data centers around the world. This is a lot of effort for them. And
The infrastructure investment up front is obviously huge. And so, but yeah, I think that's actually been one of the biggest concerns with this from the get-go is the economics. The economics of streaming games over the internet. And, you know, if you're selling a game on DVD for someone to play on their Xbox, it's using up the equivalent electricity of fractions of a penny per minute or something. You know, it's just like the electricity and really, I mean, if you want to go big picture, we could talk about the effects of this for the planet. You know, we could have the conversation about how Bitcoin is destroying the planet and how Google Stadia could be the you know, another example of wasted energy. But yeah, anyways, I think that's a concern. It really is that, you know, it will cost dimes, not fractions of pennies, you know, per hour or whatever it is, you know, and to stream these games over the internet, not just for Google, you know, for the infrastructure for them, but the fact that you have to have a really good internet connection to do this. And so what's the cost there with, you know, if your kid is, if you've got a 30-35 megabit connection and your kid is playing a game upstairs in his room, there's a cost there too, where it's like, you know, some other people
not
in the house.
Not mentioned data caps.
Oh yeah, data caps and the cost of going over those for sure. And then also just, you know, feeling, okay, we need to upgrade the internet. We need to have a fast internet connection, and we need to pay more for internet every month because our kid's playing GTA 5 on Stadia every day. And it's like, it just seems like wasted electricity, wasted energy, wasted money if that kid could be playing that exact same game on a dumb TV and an Xbox One, you know?
Yeah.
So
the barriers to success are the audience is one, but I think the second most surprising one right now is like the business side of whether this is actually going to work for Google in the long run.
Yeah, and honestly, I think the only solution to Stadia lasting longer than a few years, which is like the average Google product lifespan, for Stadia outliving most things and getting to Gmail types of legendary lifespan, we have to see this thing blow up scale-wise. Like, this has to blow up like Netflix. Absolutely. Like, it has to reach critical mass for there to be revenue coming in from it that Google would even consider to continue investing in it. If this, especially with Google being as fiscally responsible as they've been the last few years,
seems
like a money pit.
Up an internal game studio, Stadia Games and Entertainment. They have people making first party titles. Artists not come cheap.
Yep. And just like they do with everything, they're putting all of their muscle behind it at the beginning, right? Like that's the Google way. They tend to put their muscle behind everything full force in the early days.
They like being technical. They like doing technically impressive things that nobody has done before.
Yeah, and they have the money to, and they have the money to give things a chance to try things. And this is yet another thing that they're trying. And I just don't see. After a few years, it's going to be really sad when it's like this has not reached critical mass and people have libraries of 10, 20 games. And I wonder sometimes how much is the culture aware of this trend, of this reputation that Google has of just launching things and killing things. And I agree with you. I personally don't really think that the culture, most people who would be tempted to sign on for Stadia are aware of that. Yeah. And so I don't know if there's any marketing that they have to do to say, hey, we're going to actually keep your libraries online for more than a few years. But then again, I really do think if people are asking me, hey, should I sign up for Stadia? That has to be something that I mention at least. Like, there's a...
Even if the entire commitment is just $9.99 per month, $120 a year, even if they're just, it's casual, how much resonance do you apply to a casual game that you play on your phone? I think the casualness is the key here. In terms of that, this is just
yeah,
it's for fun.
Sure,
and you
sure.
Don't, most people don't want to put effort and thought into just like something they do for fun.
Yeah, what's funny is I think that the free Stadia, which yes. is the one that I think people will raise their eyebrows at, because it's like, oh, that's free. I can play games for free. Honestly, I think the free Stadia is a worse long-term value than just subscribing to the $10 a month and just playing whatever games they offer.
Yeah.
Because if you're playing free Stadia and you pay $60 for a game here and $60 for a game there, you know, that adds up really fast. You know, $60 for one game is 6 months on the subscription service. And, you know,
especially if you just want to play something, you don't really care at the end of the day. You just want to wind into something.
If you buy six games, that's what, you know, $60 games.
$360.
Yeah, that's you know, 3 whole years of Stadia Pro membership, and that might be more time than Stadia stays alive. You know, and that's the pessimistic side, but you know, that's the absolute worst case scenario. But all it takes is six games to potentially pay more than you would have paid for 10 or 3 years of how long the service might last completely. So anyways, that's my 2 cents on it. I think if you're going to do it, do Stadia Pro and do the Founders thing if you're going to do it, for sure. I think so.
Yeah. You got a cool with the logo. You got an exclusive Midnight Blue controller.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to talk about the colors, actually.
Yeah. I love the Wasabi name.
Yes, it's that one. That's... I thought it was going to be mint or something, but I wonder if that's what we're going to see a Pixel 4 this year with in Wasabi just to match this controller. It's a good one.
It's so good. I think Wasabi is the perfect name. It matches perfectly, I think.
Yeah.
I want one really bad. I probably will buy the Founders thing sometime in the next couple months, just because I really want a Wasabi controller. If nothing else, this is going to be a piece of Google history.
You have to buy it separately. That's the thing.
Oh.
So you only get the Midnight Blue.
That's right. You're stuck with the Midnight one.
Oh. But arguably, the Midnight Blue is the best one, because the Stadia logo in the middle is colored. And it's like, it's colored orange, whether it's compared to white. But that's a minor detail.
Anyways, so yeah, that's Stadia. And it will be launching in November. That's what we didn't get to that. Launch date, November something. So keep an eye out for that.
It's far away. It's further away than most of us expect.
Yes.
But at the same time,
it makes sense.
Just to close out. Yeah. There's still a lot. They announced a lot today, but at the same time, there's still so many questions. We haven't seen what the interface for Stadia is yet. The home screen interface, the game selector. There's 100% going to be a social networking aspect to this, and Google has not touched on that in any form whatsoever.
Looking forward to a future Stadia Connect.
Yeah. So. And the Stadia social network, which help us all.
Yep. So anyways, the other thing that happened this week was Android Q Beta 4, which brings a lot of new stuff. More stuff than any of the betas so far, I think, except the first one, obviously.
I agree.
A lot of minor things, though. And I honestly, if you aren't using this device, or if you're not using Android Q beta on a daily basis, you probably wouldn't have noticed much different. But we had a lot of minor things, the most minor of which being slightly bolder date and weather widgets on the home screen for Pixel devices.
Yes, the Pixel launcher. Yeah.
And I was really disappointed, because in Google's embargo, I don't know if I can say this. I think embargo's up, whatever. In Google's embargo for beta 4, and what maybe previous betas, maybe Ron correct me on this one, but there's a GIF.
Beta 3, yeah.
There's a GIF in there of what looks to be much improved gesture navigation. It looks smoother to me in that GIF. And not only that, it looks like they widened the gesture
key
bar thing at the bottom. It looks like he's pointed out, and you've pointed out, and others have pointed out, that it looks like this GIF. If you haven't seen it, just go over 9to5 Google and look for our Android Q Beta 4 post. It looks like it was just chopped up, which it may be. But I was really hoping, with that GIF being in the embargo, that we would have some kind of, you know, fixed up, cleaned up gesture navigation, and that has not happened. Well, I won't say it hasn't happened. It's just it is slightly better. It's smoother, I think. There's yeah. It's less randomly glitchy than the last one, but it's just still not fluid at all. So looking forward to final release, because that was when the gesture nav finally got fixed on the last one. So
I have to confront you on something.
What?
You have a controversial opinion that Google's will remove the back gesture.
Yeah.
From the sides. I don't. How else would they do it? Is my question.
Do they need it? That's my question.
Yes, they do. How else do you go back?
I think that it wouldn't. Maybe it won't happen this year. But I think that the move that's going to happen is that the back button, the Android concept of back is going that's away. Gone. And that the app guidelines will be, you know,
rejiggered
to say if you have any kind of back function in your app, you use a back button, right? Specifically. Yeah, yeah. Which I mean, most apps already do this. Yeah. I've talked about this so many times over the last few years, and that's the back situation on Android is a mess, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it made sense when the back button on the bottom of the screen was a shortcut. AKA the ability to go back without having to reach your thumb all the way to the top left corner of the screen. That's really why that back button exists. It exists because your thumb is only so long. And unfortunately for Google, Apple has the intellectual property on the swipe left or swipe in from the left side of the screen to go back in an app functionality. Yeah. They have the patent on that. So that's something that Google can't copy, unfortunately. I really wish they could. Because I think that's the ideal situation, not just because it's the way Apple does it, but because I think it actually is the best UX. And what has happened is that apps have both. They have a back function that is in the top left corner in most cases. It's usually a back arrow or, you know, whatever. And there's a button, and there has been a button up until Android P. Even in Android P, it comes back and goes away back button.
Again, I have to repeat, I still like the Android P gesture navigation.
I don't think it's terrible. I just think that this one's going to be better. I think it will. It's not better right now, but it will be. That's my theory. I don't know if it's happening this year, but If you notice, the back gesture thing in Android has gone more and more away over the last 24 months, and I think taking that to its logical conclusion will be the disappearance of back in Android, which I claps and cheers for me for that one.
Okay. So let's see other features in beta 4. The lock screen. So the lock screen was tweaked so that the lock icon, which has been getting progressively larger through the betas, is no longer at the bottom of the screen, but at the very top. So much like how Face ID works. So the logical jump there is that face unlock is coming.
Yeah, not only that, but we found references to face authentication settings in the Android Q Beta 4 Pixel Settings app.
Yes.
So, not only is the lock button moved to the top, just like it is on the iPhone, there's very clearly going to be settings for face authentication. And to me, that signals that we're not going to have... I don't think that Google's going to do some silly camera-based face authentication. If they're going to do something, they're going to try and argue that it's as good as Face ID. Whether that's accomplished by hardware, which is the case with the iPhone does, or by some kind of fancy pants AI system.
I have to argue with you there. I think Face Match is proven by the Nest Hub. I think they're going to just do. They're just going to buy it with the camera.
Think so?
Maybe just on the Pixel.
Well, I mean, that's what I said. It may just be the camera, but if it is, they're going to argue that it's just as secure because AI. I mean, that's Google's answer to everything. Because AI.
Yeah. So yeah, Face Match is a perfect guide. You and I think we expect this last year with Pixel 3 a lot. some kind of face authentication comes, but I guess it's better to wait than never.
Yeah, my original thought when we first saw the huge notch on the Pixel 3 XL screen protectors in like April of last year.
Yeah.
My initial thought was there's only one possible reason that it could be this big, and that's because they're doing some kind of infrared or some additional sensor for facial recognition stuff. But nope.
Yeah.
Wide angle selfies.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, Android Cube 8 default.
It's good. Is it stable enough for you to use as your daily driver? Probably not.
It's getting there. Yes, as long as you don't use the gesture navigation.
Ooh. What about Google Pay cards? What's your thoughts on this? I want to know you think about this.
Our Dylan was able to spot in.
We can call him Dylan Roussel now. He's gone public with his last name.
Pronouncing last names, so that's why I obviously always skew against.
I think it's Roussel. I don't know.
My point exactly. So, there's this I guess you'd call it a gesture. This ability where when you turn it on in settings and you press the lock button, when you press and hold on the power button, it shows you your Google Pay cards, your transit passes, your credit cards, your debit cards, whatever, so that you can more easily pay. This makes a lot of sense in the future, in the upcoming future, where we're getting electronic IDs. Where you pay with your card, with your phone everywhere.
You can do an NFC on the New York City subway now, as of this week. So
I would have.
That's why this feature exists. They're like, oh, the subway did it. Okay, we got to put cards up right at the forefront.
But it's going to be so interesting when you can have your ID on your phone.
Yeah.
You can just, maybe it'll always be a swipe. It'll be on the left-hand side. That'll be your ID. So this is interesting. And there's a lot of stuff in Android Q, but in terms of like long-term beneficial, we're reading more futuristic lives, the start of like electronic IDs, and always have access to virtual payments. It's a good one. It's exciting.
Yeah. And I think that this is probably going to be a Pixel thing, right?
For the moment.
But seems like.
I have Google Pay. They want it everywhere.
It's always kind of hard to discern with these Android Q betas what is Android Core and what is Pixel Experience. Is that what they call it? Forget.
Not a fishery, but yeah, yes. Pixel Experience.
Yeah. And that's another thing, Pixel Presence. That's like, sometimes we see things that are just very clearly, okay, this is a Pixel specific thing. And that's one of them. Smart Lock is seemingly renamed as Pixel Presence on devices.
That's curious.
For Android
Cube. That's very curious.
It just seems like a better name and a marketing name for something that's been there for a long time.
So Smart Lock, for those that don't know, is comprised of like devices. If your phone is on, it stays on your body, it'll keep the password. You don't have to use a password to log in. It's just kind of like body detection features, that kind of stuff. And the idea of naming it the Pixel Presence implies that Google is going to do more stuff like that, like using sensor fusion to just do more smart tricks with your phone. So who knows?
Yeah, what else was there in Android Q? Beta 4, nothing really, really notable, I don't think. The digital well-being app timers, that's pretty cool. So now on the recents view, you now get some little timer showing you how much time you have left in apps that you've set for digital well-being.
How often do you use digital well-being? Do you
Me?
Check your stats?
Never.
Yeah.
And I've talked about this on the podcast too before, is it like the digital well-being stuff, both on the Apple side and... What's those called again? What's Apple's called?
Screen time.
Yeah. With screen time and with digital well-being, it's a matter of all or nothing. The data is useless to me unless it represents all of my device usage. And so on the Google side of things, you know, it's like I wear an Apple Watch and my Pixel device is not going to tell me, hey, you spent too much time looking at your Apple Watch. Or I use a MacBook all day long. My Pixel device, my data on my Pixel device is not going to tell me how much time I was on my MacBook. So, yeah, for me, digital well-being is useless for two reasons. One, because I use too much of a diversity of devices, and so my data is just so scattered, and therefore that data is useless. And the controls are useless, because it's like, oh, my Pixel is telling me, my Pixel 4, or my Pixel 3. My Pixel 3 is telling me, hey, you can't use Instagram anymore.
He has a Pixel 4, go get him.
Yeah, Pixel 4, leak, exclusive. My Pixel 3 XL is telling me, hey, you can't use Instagram anymore, and then my iPhone's like, oh, you haven't used Instagram at all today, so, you know.
Those
restrictions are really silly. I mean, Grayscale, I use that a lot on both. That's pretty much.
That's a horrible digital well-being confession, actually.
What is
it? So, do you know Wind Down, how it like automatically turns on Do Not Disturb?
Oh, yeah.
So, it's odd for me. It's always, it's set at midnight, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm usually still up past midnight. So, I kid you not, every single day, I let the DND turn on by itself, and I immediately disable it. I'm always frightened that there's some midnight rush of news. So it's on for like, Wind Down for me is on for 2 seconds every single day. And then I turn it off immediately.
So
yeah,
that's so funny. You're that paranoid that there's going to be a random Google app drop that you're going to miss.
Yes, absolutely. It's a terrifying thought.
You need to turn off sometimes, my brother. So speaking of
screen time.
Yeah, speaking of screen time, I don't know if your segue is going to be the same as mine, but my segue is going to be screen time was added to macOS Catalina.
macOS Catalina.
Which is looking great in many, many ways. I'm using macOS every day all day long, so
yeah.
Anything on macOS is WWC was a big deal for me because I use an Apple Watch and I use a MacBook a lot. Both of them came. So, and I use an iPhone a lot too. And I have an iPad Pro now. So it's like, I use a lot of Apple products. And so to me, WWC is just as exciting as Google I.O. in many ways. On Catalina, they're adding screen time, which addresses what I was just talking about, which is the problem of my devices being too scattered. And honestly, we need to open source digital or device health. We need an open platform.
Consortium.
But the problem is that this data comes from having deep level access to the operating system in all cases. So it's not like there's can be some third party that can tell you
Apple
how.
Will never let it live in the cloud.
No. It would be nice. Yeah. It would be nice. Kind of like how Google Fit on iOS can pull down your Apple Watch data or whatever.
I'm very shocked that long story short, Google Fit just steals Apple Health, basically. And it's like, I know Apple opened as a platform, but it's honestly shocking that Apple's letting the Google Fit get away with it because it's just taking all that data and processing it themselves to do smart analytics whenever that happens in the future.
I know, it's bizarre that that's allowed to happen, but I really wish they would do exactly what they've done with health. The health app with the digital health stuff. If they just made that accessible via the health app, like they do all the rest of your health data, like why is your digital health data not included in that?
Yeah,
it should
makes
be.
Sense. Absolutely.
I need someone. I need to write an op-ed about this. Digital health data and health data should be one and the same, and
yes.
I should be able to access and contribute to my health data, my digital health data across all my platforms. And there should be an open standard here, and all of the companies should just use it. Because no one, not a single person, only uses devices from one company and from one brand or on one operating system. It's just doesn't exist. And this data is immensely more useful if you can really understand how you're using digital devices across all those platforms. I even want to know, it'd be great to see long-term data of how many times have I made requests to my Google Home versus how often am I doing it now versus a year ago? That's even the kind of thing. It's like that can actually, something as subtle as that can give me an idea of how my relationship with technology is changing over time. And if I'm in Apple's ecosystem, am I using screen time to track my health data, which props to Apple for making that available on Mac now. That'll make that data much more useful. But if I'm in that ecosystem, I can't learn anything about my Google Home usage or my Pixel Watch usage or whatever. And
yeah,
I think this data would be really powerful if you could. And I would love it. Especially, so, like, as of right now, sorry, I'll get off my soapbox, but as of right now, I'm on screens all the time. And that is why, for me, the data is not useful, is because I'm on screens all the time and all this data is scattered across devices. If this data could all be unified, then I could actually use that data to analyze the screen time that I'm on all the time. And it would actually benefit me. But as of right now, it's more useless for me than most people. So
I'm surprised that you had this much to say about what is fundamentally a macOS feature.
It's not really a macOS feature. It just happened to be mentioned this week at the dub, as they're calling it.
Yes.
Apple's officially calling it dub now.
So with that in mind, did Apple really announce anything interesting for iOS? That is the most direct Android comparison to Android we can make. But an iOS on phones, did they really do anything?
I think it was the most boring of all of them, for sure. Not just boring in the sense that there wasn't anything flashy, but there was just not much at all, I don't think. I mean, they had a whole 2-minute demo for dark mode. You know, it's like the very first thing was introducing dark mode, and then they said, let's go to the demo table and show you how it works. Yeah. And it's like, we don't need to see how this works. You made all the screens darker. I don't know. It's just silly to me that they did that. And I just hyping up dark mode, and I've loved this week seeing all the contrarian opinion pieces pop up.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
The dark mode contrarianism is so strong right now. Yeah, I love it. And if there's science to back up that dark mode is actually not beneficial to, you know, winding down or beneficial for your eye biology or whatever, I want to know about it, because I was under the impression that it was.
Yeah.
So we could talk about dark mode for 10 minutes. But anyways, going back to your asking, I don't know. I don't think that anything that they did on iOS 13 for iPhones is... I mean, the redesigns of the Photos app feel like catch-up to Google Photos to me still.
It's every year is catch-up.
Everything Photos every year from Apple is catch-up to Google Photos, at least from a UX perspective.
Google didn't even have a Photos announcement.
That's true. That's a good point that I did not think about. They did not do anything with Photos this year because they're just comfortable with where they're at, I guess. I guess it's matured. Yeah. They're revamping the Mail app. They're doing an undo gesture, slightly improved multitasking, I guess. The new volume HUD. So, like, iOS for, like, what, 10 years has had a volume HUD that pops up over the whole screen.
So,
and they're just
sharp
now...
contrast. Yeah.
They're just now... And actually, it's more Android-like now.
Yeah, and in contrast, when you do the volume on Android, you're given... Do you want to see every single audio setting on your phone? Let's write up a panel.
Yeah, we need
which
a whole
sharp
panel
contrast.
I will say, though, I'd rather have that than the frustration of a mess on iOS where it's unclear what is game volume and what is silencing your phone volume. Those are two separate things on iOS, and it's very hard to know what you're adjusting when. And
because Apple doesn't believe in labeling their UIs, you'll never know.
Yeah.
Put labels,
that's
people.
A frustration of mine on iOS. Yes. So I appreciate it. It's very clear on Android. I definitely appreciate that.
So iOS on phones, then there's iPadOS.
Womp womp on phones. iPadOS is a whole other story. I mean, I don't know. I haven't used it yet. So I can't say anything really. First impression, though, is that it looks like not a revolution, but an evolution of iOS on iPad, which going back a year, I think even a year ago, iOS on iPad is the best tablet experience at the moment in terms of a UX perspective. I mean, there's so much nuance to this conversation, and I feel like so many people just pit stuff against each other without any... conversation of why things are better than other things. Mm-hmm. Like the Pixel Slate and the iPad Pro are both tablets, and they're both made by
first tier tech companies,
but they're so different. They are so different, and they're really, I think, made for different people. And even if they're not intended to be made for different people, they ended up for very different people. The iPad is like a super powerful iPhone, in my opinion.
Yes.
It's a super powerful iPhone, and a super, and especially even more so with iPad OS now, a more versatile and a more flexible iPhone and a more powerful iPhone. I did already say that. But yeah, so that's a kind of device that appeals to someone that needs that device for a certain use case. And the Pixel Slate is a less powerful desktop Chrome browser.
So the distinction I'm increasingly finding with the Pixel Slate is it's less powerful in terms of the productivity that you can do, because the iPad OS now has such a big ecosystem of like good photo editors and whatnot. But whereas on the Pixel Slate, you can go full on hardcore nerd. You can have a Linux tablet, terminal window, and that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's a Chromebook, and the best experience you get on a Chromebook is browsing the web.
Yeah,
and having a cheap device.
Which, browsing the web on a desktop class web browser that is the best web browser you can use goes far. It goes the distance in a lot of cases. You know, like, if you're a professional writer, I mean, honestly, for me, if the Pixel Slate's keyboard situation was not such a mess, the Pixel Slate would probably be a better device for me than the iPad Pro. If my job is to be in WordPress and editing articles and researching stuff and doing a lot of mouse and keyboard-based interactions of copying and pasting links and, you know, optimizing SEO for articles and editing URLs and managing domain name, you know, if I'm doing that kind of stuff, the Pixel Slate should be better than the iPad Pro. One of the biggest reasons up until now, I don't know how this is changing with iPad OS, but up until now, the biggest difference, I think, was that Chrome on Chromebooks / Pixel Slate was a desktop class web browsing experience, and the iPad Safari browser is not, or was not, and it is becoming that. I think it is with iPad OS 13. I haven't tried it yet, like I said, but you know, that was the biggest differentiator, and it seems minor, but it means there's lots of web apps that you can use, especially since there's official keyboard and mouse support on a Pixel Slate, for example. There's lots of web apps and web experiences that you can use on a Chromebook and on a Pixel Slate you can't hardly use at all on the web on an iPad Pro. So the iPad Pro's prowess and strength and computational power was being wasted by the fact that it didn't have a professional level web browser. So I think that's going to be, honestly, with iPad OS 13, I think that is the biggest thing. And one of Apple's WWDC callouts actually was Google. They specifically called out Google Sheets and Google Docs and all the G Suite as, yeah, we know this has been crap or impossible to use on the iPad browser up until now. And now we're putting a desktop class Safari browser on it. And so you'll be able to use these things at least better. So anyways, I forgot where I was going with that, but
different devices.
They're just so different. And I agree with you. Going back to what you're saying about, I think the variety of ways you can be productive, the kinds of ways you can be productive, truly productive, is far greater on the iPad Pro. The fact that there's professional level design apps that actually run really well on the iPad Pro. Not to mention the experience and the ecosystem of having the Apple Pencil, which is now down to 9 milliseconds
half the
latency of the already ridiculously fast low latency plus 120 hertz display situation on the iPad Pro. It's just crazy how good the iPad Pro is for creatives, for drawing, and for stuff like that.
Creatives.
It's just, there's no competition at all. And the Pixel Slate is kind of like, they tried to do some of those things, but it's kind of a hodgepodge of Android apps that do and don't work well. and a $100 stylus with a AAA battery on the inside.
It's four A's, I think.
Oh yeah, it's quadruple A battery.
Quadruple A batteries.
Which you can't hardly find anywhere. That's my biggest problem with this. I've had to replace the battery, and I couldn't find one.
Yeah, it's not a promising little device, is it?
It's too expensive.
Yeah.
Really, anyway, I'll just say this, my final note on that, the Apple Pencil versus Pixelbook Pen situation. The value, they're the same. They're both ridiculously overpriced pieces of metal, or in the case of the Apple Pencil, I guess, polycarbonate. Mm. What justifies is the Apple Pencil is that the Apple Pencil, you're paying way too much for the physical hardware, but the experience you get is worth the price. The experience you get with the Apple Pencil is you can clip it on magnetically to the side of your iPad and it charges wirelessly. You never lose it. And it wirelessly charges through the edge of the device. That's insane and awesome. And as I mentioned, it has ridiculously low latency, and there's actually apps to use it with that are really, really great. So it justifies the price, not by the hardware, but by the experience you get by buying it. That's not the case on this thing.
Yeah.
You get a little piece of plastic that you can take notes with. That's essentially what you get at the end of the day with Pixelbook Pen. So,
yeah.
Anyways, sorry.
I guess we can... The watch, there's no... I think we can sum up watchOS as being no comparison to Wear OS right now.
Yeah, no comparison. No way. There's nothing to compare with.
But to go back to this iPad for a second, the Pixel Slate today. There was some Pixel Slate news today.
Actually, I do want to say something on watch, and this is a thought. I probably need to put this on paper, but the biggest thing that the watch has on Google's Wear OS situation, besides the fact that Wear OS doesn't exist, really, is that I think the biggest thing Apple has done right is that they've picked extremely specific ways that the Apple Watch can be used for real needs. So, the addition of EKG last year, that's an extremely specific technology that had to be built out that is a niche use case. I admit, I mean, I don't do EKGs in my watch every day, but it's a useful use case for many people, and it makes it a more powerful health device. This decibel thing, the ambiently detecting decibels, it's a niche use case. You only use it when you go to concerts, right? But yeah. It is a genuinely useful health feature that works well. And so, you know, just all these little things, you know.
You make a story.
They're just little pieces that over the course of the last 5 years have been built out that are actually genuinely useful. And they haven't, like, they took their time with them. They could have added, menstrual cycle tracking. They could have added that like 5 years ago, but they didn't. And they took their time. And I'm sure they actually did market research to figure out how they could actually make this app useful for women. And, you know, anyways, that high level, that's what I wish Google would do. So I wish they would just take their time on very specific niche health related important use cases and have their own hardware to back that up.
Yes.
Anyways, go on.
The Pixel Slate.
Yeah.
Google, it's funny, there was one hardware announcement in the Stadia controller today, but Google also taketh with the Celeron Pixel Slates, the $5.99 and $6.99 undiscounted price that were only available for a hot minute when the Pixel Slate first launched, are now gone from the Google store, with Google previously saying that they're just out of stock, that they might come back, but that was clearly not the case today.
It was clearly not the case a long time ago.
Yeah. So, I don't think there are any tiers, as long as Google keeps the $5.99 price point on the Pixel Slate M3, Intel Core M3. But besides that, this was a very much reflects the Pixel Slate story.
Yep. This is how it should have been from day one. M3 should have been $5.99, and that would have changed the reviews a lot, in my opinion.
Yes, not $7.99. Oh, hell, go to $4.99 and be the original iPad price.
Yeah, they could have delivered pretty good value for the money in terms of hardware, which would have, I think would have changed the story. even though the software experience is not great, it's, I think the story would have been more like, this is a pretty good value for a Chromebook.
Yes.
And that was my argument, really. It was like, this is an okay value for a Chromebook. It's a bad value for a Chromebook in light of the Pixelbook being in a year earlier generation i5 for less money.
Yeah.
So, so on the Pixel slate, what do you think about this? Do you think this changes any of the calculus for whether or not we recommend it, whether or not you recommend it? Is it too late?
No, it's too late. It's the thing. Okay, there's talk of an upcoming Chrome OS update in drastically improving productivity, the experience on the Pixel slate. But let's say that's true. Google has to publicize the fact that their first take on the Chromebook on the Pixel slate was kind of bad. They would have to do another push on this device, which is several months in right now, that hasn't sold well at all. So Google would have to try again. And the question is, do they want to try again with this form factor, or do they just want to quietly let it go into the night at this point?
Yeah, the question is does Google have a vision for tablets? Do they have a plan for tablets? Do they have any desire to try and take down Apple's
iPad dominance?
Yeah, or at least challenge it. And if they do, then they'll do a second generation device, and they'll take the feedback that they got from this first catastrophic failure, and they will improve the situation, and they'll make it more compelling, and make this less of a situation where it's impossible to recommend versus the competition. And you know, that's the question. And recent reports have suggested that the tablet/laptop divisions got, even as recently as a few months ago, well, I guess what I mean is even as quickly that quickly after launch of the Pixel slate, got pulled back a little bit. I don't know how. I think we talked about that. I don't think that's necessarily indicative of Pixelbook being canceled or whatever, but yeah, I think that's the question. Is Google going to stick with laptops and Chromebooks, or are they going to actually try and do another tablet? And I think they should keep trying, because I think the way you build good products is very slowly over a long period of time. And that's the only reason that the iPad is as dominant as it was, as it is. It took, I mean, the iPad's been around for 7 years. It took a really long time to mature into the product that it is today.
That's fair. That's absolutely fair.
How would the Pixel slate look like in 7 years if they kept investing every year?
What if the Pixel slate were like the original Pixel phone, the Pixel 1, where it got critical acclaim out of the box? What if that was the case? There was a path to the Pixel slate being successful, and it looks a lot more like the one product, hardware product that Google hit a home run on with phones.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, none of the Google trying to launch premium products to go against Apple situations are going well.
No.
Pixelbook's going the best, and it's not going well.
No, it's not. It's expensive. It's a hard story.
So, yeah, that's really the thing. I'm high level. That's the thing I'm looking for this fall, is how does the story around Google's premium products change?
Because when they found success with the 3A.
Yeah, the 3A is the beginning of that. It's changing the story a little bit, piece by piece. What I would hope Google will do for at least a couple more years is just try to keep building the best premium products they can, and just see how that shakes out.
Yeah, they have. I think the going talk is that they have Rick Astor had 5 years to implement this plan.
Yeah.
Two more years.
It's got three premium product lines that are struggling.
Is that including the whole Macs or not?
No. I'm thinking Pixel Slate, Pixelbook, and Pixel.
Yeah.
So, who knows? Maybe Google will do a budget tablet. Pixel Slate A.
Pixel Slate AA, that might be something. Because again, at the end of the day, it's promising. Like, the iPad is unchallenged.
And you know what?
Moment.
Why? With all of the strength I know that there's the whole like taking pictures on tablets is funny kind of situation.
Yeah.
But with all of the strength they've have in cameras, why was not part of the Pixel Slate story? Okay, all of these things about it may suck, but it has a killer camera because the Pixel is about killer cameras. Why was that not part of the story?
And the screen is good on the Pixel Slate.
I know. Like, part of the story could have been, yeah, it looks dorky holding this thing up to take pictures, but it's a Pixel, and it takes killer photos, and the screen is awesome at displaying them. And yeah. I don't know. That just seems like it could have been an easy win. One part of the narrative that could have gone right, because that's really been the Pixel story too, right? Like every year it's like, it's got all these downsides, it's worse than Samsung Galaxy S10 and it's worse than the iPhone in these ways, but it's got a killer camera. And I think Google should try and stick that reputation out as much as possible before they lose it.
Yeah, the Pixel, it's
a
good brand. Milk it all the way.
So anyways, I think that's the show. I think we're good. I think that rounds things out pretty well. Sorry for all the Apple talk. Actually, no, I'm not sorry. Deal with it. this is a pretty packed show. We'll see how next week goes, because
it seemed like
everything happened in the last week.
Yeah, and we definitely thought we were going to expect Stadia in the summer.
I wasn't expecting it this early.
Oh, but in terms of the actual launch.
Oh,
in
yeah.
In terms of like, that's what we'd be spending our summer on.
Right.
That and the Nest Hub Max, but November. So just a busier fall for us.
I'm going to make a prediction.
Yes.
My prediction is this week ahead of us, this is going to be the week that we see some kind of notable Pixel 4 leak. I'm not saying it's going to be everything's coming out. This is going to be the week we're going to see a screen protector or a Geekbench.
A real screen protector, mind you.
Something. We're going to see something. I don't guarantee it. I'm just going to take a guess that by the time we talk next.
Yeah.
We're starting to feel it, aren't we? I'm starting to feel it. Like there's got to be something somewhere. Someone's got something. Someone has the dimensions of the thing that they got from some Chinese factory or something. They've got that sitting on their hard drive right now. They just haven't leaked it yet. And it's coming.
Yeah.
It's coming. Mark my words. Not from me, probably. Sorry. don't take this as any kind of hint that I have some crazy scoop coming this week for Pixel 4. Anyways, until next week, you can tune in to Alphabet Scoop here every week. We record this podcast every Wednesday. Actually, just note here, we'll be recording on Thursdays for the summer because I've got a class conflict, so we're just going to do that. We'll publish on Friday mornings, probably. You can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms, such as iTunes and Apple Podcasts. RIP iTunes, so just Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Google Play, and you can also listen directly over 95google.com. Thanks for tuning in, as always, and Abner and I will see you next week.
Bye.
Later.